All right, welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and today I'm excited to bring you another live interview that I did recently, this time with Dr. Edward Vickers, professor of comparative education at Kyushu University, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Education and Society in Post-Mao China. He co-authored this book with Xiaodong Zeng, professor at Beijing Normal University. And actually, Beijing Normal University is where Dr. Vickers and I met. We were at a conference on education, and it was really great to hear his research. And then after the conference, we got together and interviewed live for this book. So I think it's a special occasion where we can actually be in the same room while doing the interview, which may be sometimes rare on this network since we're sort of getting authors from all over the world. So I think you're really going to enjoy this one. All right. Welcome, Dr. Vickers. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me.
If we could, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, maybe your educational background,
Okay.
sort of what you're doing right now. Yeah.
Well, at the moment, I'm a professor of comparative education at Kyushu University in Japan. And I've been there for the last 5 years. But of course, the book we're talking about is on China. Mm-hmm. And I spent about 12 years living and working in China. Most of that time in Hong Kong. I was originally a school teacher there. But I spent 3 years living in Beijing, where I was working for the People's Education Press.
Oh, very nice.
Helping them revise English textbooks
during
the big curriculum reform in the early 2000s.
Oh, fantastic. Interesting. And how did this project come together with your co-author?
Well, Professor Zeng is a professor here at Beijing Normal University.
Mm.
And I met her almost 10 years ago when we were involved in organizing a conference together. And of course, 10 years ago was the 30th anniversary of reform and opening. So there was quite a lot of stuff in the media here in China about the 30th anniversary and basically sort of celebrating the achievements of 30 years of reform and opening. Now we're coming up to 40 years.
Wow.
And she, in fact, suggested to me that we might work together on putting on writing a book that perhaps was slightly less sort of celebratory or sort of simple-mindedly celebratory than some of the stuff that was coming out then.
I see.
Certainly, you know, here within China itself. But that tried to construct a coherent narrative also of the trajectory of education's development in China since the beginning of the reform and opening period.
Yeah, interesting. So it looks at post-Mao, but then also like reform and opening, like all of these things sort of happen.
Well, post-Mao effectively is reform and
right.
opening. I mean, there's a sort of hiatus of two years. But one of the interesting, technically Mao dies in 1976, reform and opening is officially launched in 1978. But the interesting thing about education is that, in a sense, education actually pre-launched reform and opening. The first aspect, I think, of the entire social system, the range of social policy that was reformed was education.
Yeah.
Because, in a sense, the central purpose of the Cultural Revolution was to undermine the connection between cultural capital and social and political power, ostensibly.
Right.
And when Mao was off the scene and the elites who'd been rusticated or sidelined came back into power after 1976, their first priority.
Yeah, interesting. That was the first year they brought back the Gaokao or the interest.
Exactly. So reform and opening technically began in 1978. 1977, the Gaokao was relaunched.
Right.
And various other education policies were.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. I think, I think it's good to think like, well, we often consider this like one time 78 and all these other things, but baby steps, I guess, can be something how we can describe.
Well, and in a sense, educational reforms were the easy bit to sort of get past the various factions within the Communist Party. These were something that they could pretty much all unite around.
Right.
Largely, of course, because established elites within the party could see that, if you want to be cynical, that they had a vested interest in it.
Right.
But I think also because, to not be so cynical, many of them realized that the Cultural Revolution had been hugely destructive, particularly of higher education.
Right.
And from Dunn on down saw the reconstruction of higher education and
specifically,
the reconstruction of educational institutions directed towards an elite as a priority.
Right. And how much then was there a separation from 78 or post-Mao with basic education and secondary? I mean, was that as sharp? I mean, you just said like higher education was definitely, but how about with the other?
Well, range? I mean, to put it very simply, the difference between the early reform and opening period and the Cultural Revolution in terms of education is a difference. It's a swing from a system and a set of policies that were heavily focused on promoting equality through education to an orientation that's very much more elitist. I mean, it's a radical swing of the pendulum, really, from one extreme to the other.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So the organization of the book, you sort of have, you know, the introduction, obviously, and then you go through early childhood, different funding, ideology, valuation, and then you sort of go into marketization, all these other things. So I'm curious, like, how you and your co-author sort of think about these sort of areas as different from one another, or how did you create this sort of organization?
Well, I mean, the book starts off by trying to set China's educational record in comparative context and also in historical context.
Right.
So the first sort of quarter of the book tries to construct a narrative to give an overall picture of the sort of trajectory of education, I suppose primarily education policy in the post-Mao period. And then we sort of break down the story into segments that look at different sectors or different themes.
Right.
But one of the things that we felt that was missing from a lot of existing scholarship on education in China in the contemporary period is, firstly, that kind of historical perspective. There are more edited volumes, for example, than you can shake a stick at, looking at
like a single sort of...
Well, various issues or themes related to education in China now.
Right.
But there hasn't really been a book that's tried to explain how the development of the education system overall fits into the sort of broader story of China's post-Mao development.
Right.
And especially how the development of the education system has been conditioned by the politics of post-Mao China.
Yeah, interesting.
A lot of work on education tends to be, I don't know how to put this, written from a rather sort of meliorist perspective. How do we make things better?
Right. So maybe looking forward, I suppose, then sort of.
Looking forward, perhaps, but also, yes. But also what we call in the book a sort of practice-oriented perspective.
Sure, okay.
And a lot of the work on China, particularly until the early 21st century, certainly a lot of work in English has been somehow related to development project work. So a lot of researchers who've come into China to do work on education have, in a sense, come in on the bandwagon of development aid agencies.
Sure.
And for understandable reasons, that kind of conditions or the focus of a lot of this research.
Right.
How do we make things better? But what we felt a lot of research on education in China has not done is to consider, you know, how we define what better is or what better should be in educational terms.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And what the purposes of education are in a state like China.
Does the book struggle with that? Because there was, within the Cultural Revolution, of maybe a kind of massification of bringing people in from the countryside who maybe didn't have any sort of education and raising literacy rates and these kinds of things. Does it look into sort of that dichotomy, but then all of the other terrible things that are going on at the same time?
Well, what was education policy in the Cultural Revolution really about? I mean, I just said you see a swing from egalitarianism in the Cultural Revolution to elitism, put very crudely, in the post-Mao period. And that's a very important swing. And the elitism of policies from the early post-Mao period onwards has sort of helped to bake inequality into Chinese society more broadly in very important ways. But besides promoting egalitarianism, what was education policy in the Cultural Revolution about, or other aspects of social policy? It's ultimately about control. And for Mao and the Cultural Revolutionary leadership, an egalitarian education policy was largely about mobilizing the masses, mobilizing the masses in support of the central leadership and bypassing the party and the party apparatus, the party and state apparatus in the process. That's particularly true in the early stages of the Cultural Revolution, but to a large extent, you know, that sort of orientation distinguishes the Cultural Revolution from what came before and particularly what came afterwards. But also, education policy in the post-Mao period has also been very much about control. I mean, what, as I said just now, we have to think about, you know, what kind of state China is. You know, what are the purposes of education in a state such as this?
But it seems more now, or since 78 or post-Mao, it's embedding it within the party apparatus, whereas you're talking about before.
I mean, the party state effectively has been reconstructed in the post-Mao period. And in the process, in some ways, turned to somewhat different purposes. Or at least, as everybody knows, it's been focused very much on promoting economic growth. But is economic growth the ultimate purpose of the party state? Perhaps not. I mean, the purpose of a party state, by its nature, is the maintenance of control. And so I think when we look at the development of education in China, it's crucial to bear that in mind. And a lot of the existing literature, particularly if it's literature that's been that's arisen out of research connected to development aid projects, is not going to look at those kinds of issues. So one of the things we're trying to do with this book is inject politics back into the narrative, or remind people of the relationships between the politics of post-Mao China and strategies for educational development.
So one of the, I think, characteristics of Chinese education right now is highly competitive environment. Do you, and one of your chapters, marketization and competition. And so I'm wondering if you sort of can look and or do you look and map sort of how that sort of grew and became like this pressure cooker that we see right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, we try to do that in that chapter, but also to a large extent in other chapters of the book. I mean, this competition allied to inequality. And also allied to the imperative of control. I mean, this is a sort of equation that runs throughout the book. The point's been made by other scholars, not necessarily working in education, but in other fields, that in some respects you look at China, you look at some of the policy rhetoric, you look at the government's use of marketization and competition, and this all looks quite neoliberal.
The competition model, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the regime here talks about socialism with Chinese characteristics, but David Harvey has coined the phrase neoliberalism with Chinese characteristics. And you can certainly talk about neoliberalism with Chinese characteristics, and look at how the regime in education, as in other areas, has used competition and used marketization to, in at certain times and in certain places, raise revenue for education in ways that reduce the burden on the state.
Sure.
But also, you know, as we see in America, in Britain, competition, setting up a competition is one way in which states seek to exercise control.
Mm.
So in universities, for example, if you want to control academics, what do? You make research funding conditional on competitive applications and reduce core funding.
Right. Okay, yeah. I mean, we're sitting here at this, you know, in Beijing, and we just kind of came back from a conference and talking about these kinds of things. And I think especially now, not just thinking about domestic competition, but, and you talk about it at the back of your book, is the international competition that's becoming a hallmark of Chinese higher education. So can you kind of talk about that connection?
Well, of course, everybody knows, if they know anything about Chinese education, that you know, Shanghai was topping the PISA tables for performance of 15-year-olds,
right?
At least until the latest round, when China sort of included more cities or provinces, slipped down those rankings,
right?
There are some scholars who look at the impact of neoliberalism on Chinese public policymaking, who look at the importance that Chinese policymakers attach to these league tables, and say, well, look, you know, China is basically being influenced by these wider discourses out there in the world today about education, what education's for, educational competition, and China is sort of racing to catch up with the West. And so in a sense, you find some scholars arguing that, that Chinese policymakers or Chinese educators have somehow been brainwashed or allowed themselves to be brainwashed into accepting that sort of externally imposed paradigm for educational success. But actually, if you look at how the state works within China and how control is exercised, the Chinese state is a ranking state.
Sure.
Everything is ranked.
Right.
Everything is numbered.
Yeah.
Control over officials of all kinds, at all levels, is exercised largely through a ranking and scoring process.
Right.
Control over teachers as a profession.
Right.
It works in much the same way. Teachers then... you know, within the schooling system, are constantly testing and ranking students. Everyone, almost everything, is tested and ranked all the time.
Right.
So when the OECD comes along with this testing and ranking system, well, that paradigm kind of, you know, it's a perfect match. It's a match made in
Chinese
socialist heaven.
Yeah, I guess. Interesting. I mean, I agree. I mean, we look at, I study rankings personally, but beyond that, it's amazing how attuned so many people are here with like that sort of paradigm. Whereas maybe in the United States, there's less of a thinking about these kinds of things. Potentially, we still have, I think, quite a bit of that, but not ingrained into maybe every single sort of policy. And we certainly wouldn't, you know, put up a class rank where everyone can sort of see where each student is ranked, stuff, things like that. I think that would be out of bounds for...
Well, and if you take the sort of ranking competition phenomenon to the most sort of mundane level, the level of individuals and families, China now, and certainly urban China, has a mass education system. Mass higher education system.
Sure.
Higher education, I think here in Beijing, if you take the sort of officially resident Beijing population, probably participation rates in higher education are in the range of, you know, 70%, 80%.
Right.
It's like Korea. It's
like
Japan.
Highest in the world.
Probably higher.
Urban areas.
And in the late 1990s, the central government took the decision to expand higher education. Mm-hmm. Having, for most of that, the period, especially post-Tiananmen, tried to keep numbers down. And obviously, you know, I think that has something to do with a sense within the party that having too many students was not necessarily, too many university students, not necessarily a good thing.
Right.
Particularly if you weren't sure about the capacity of the economy to absorb
career and these kinds of things.
But during the 1990s, you have the liberalization of the labor market.
Mm.
By the mid-late 1990s, the rates of economic growth were rapidly increasing. Although, 1997, you have the East Asian financial crisis.
Right.
And it was at that point that the government took the decision to expand access to higher education, really very in a sort of big bang.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite clear that one of the main reasons for that decision was to unlock family savings.
Mm. An injection.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other things that happened during the 1990s was the introduction of student fees across the higher education sector, which happened in tandem with the liberalization of the labor market.
Mm.
So once higher education became a sort of fee paid,
right,
and ineffectively, therefore, potentially a consumption good, a marketized product, you had the basis for rapid expansion of higher education as a means of actually contributing to economic growth.
Right.
And that was how the government saw it in the context of the East Asian financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think actually anyone, certainly at the policy level, expected the massification of higher education to happen on quite the scale that it has happened.
Right. Well, now it's the biggest sector in the world, unless India passed it while we were chatting or something. But
yeah, I don't think so. but that has contributed to the intense competitiveness of the education system right the way down the line.
Right.
So in the early 1990s, 2% of the relevant cohort, 2-3%, were entering college.
Right.
Now, I think across the country as a whole, it's mid-20s, you know, getting on for 30%.
Yeah.
And as we said, in urban areas, much higher.
Right, absolutely.
And of course, everybody's competing within the sector to get into the most prestigious institutions. But what that means is that the competitiveness, which maybe in the past was restricted to the elite sector, or more concentrated in, amongst a relatively small elite, is now something that's spread to the whole of society.
Right.
And along with that has developed a huge shadow education system, which feeds that competitiveness.
Sure.
And which again absorbs huge amounts of people's savings.
Yeah, absolutely.
In what I think we can say is a at the very least, not a very productive manner.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it also then, I mean, connected outside of China and connected to your final chapter, the international dimension, the spillover from people who are trying to get into the elite spaces of higher education, there's not enough space now.
Mm.
And so then they're spilling over to countries around the world and filling up classrooms and these.
And in the process, you know, this is of course fueling competitiveness in higher education systems elsewhere. You could argue,
sure.
But I mean, within Chinese society and in other societies that are similarly affected by the same sort of competitiveness,
right?
Particularly here in East Asia,
sure.
I mean, the costs involved, are not just financial families, but of course they're psychological.
Right. Moving across the world and
the pressure
on you,
That are involved in a system like this are absolutely huge.
Mm. Especially with the in China specifically, one child.
Yeah.
Where you're sort of putting all your eggs into one basket's take that phrase.
But if you combine one child policy this intensely competitive, test-driven system, culture. One of the factors, I think, driving the intensity of competitiveness here and to some extent in other East Asian societies is the minimal nature of welfare provision, which in here in China to some extent has improved in the last 10 years. But basically, you can't afford as a Chinese citizen to depend on universal entitlements provided by the state.
Right.
Because either there aren't any, or if they are, they're really not sufficient for a sort of dignified existence. And that's something that I think really drives educational competitiveness.
Yeah.
Families are investing in their, until recently, mostly singleton children.
Right.
They have to.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the phenomenon of competitiveness and credentialism is sometimes seen as a sort of craze.
Right.
Sort of, as if it's somehow irrational.
Right.
But it's perfectly rational in a society like this.
Right.
Yeah. But to come back to the theme of control, that competitiveness is also, I think, quite an effective way of diverting energies amongst youth, amongst families, amongst citizens that might otherwise be focused on other areas.
Right.
Focusing it or ensuring that it's focused primarily on the pursuit of competitive advantage.
Yeah. All the time investment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I mean, we came through so many different healthcare, large scale politics, international, there's so many different connections, I think, for this book. I mean, who do you hope grabs this book? Who do you hope picks this up and reads it, checks it out?
Well, one group of people I hope might read it, or if not the whole of it, but just, the salient bits, introduction and conclusion, are in fact Western policymakers, because I'm sick of picking up the paper and reading these articles about how wonderful the Chinese education system is and how we can, we should America, Britain, Australia, wherever, should be learning from China. When I was in Britain 2 months ago, I read an article about Shanghai's maths textbooks being the rights,
the model
to them being bought up by Heinemann, I think it was.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen
publisher,
that. Yeah.
So that they could be translated into English and thereby transform the educational prospects of a generation of English school children.
Okay.
I mean, this is absolute rubbish.
Yeah.
And I would hope that anyone who's read this book will understand why that's the case.
Okay. Fantastic. And usually the last question we ask on New Books Network, what are you working on next? What's the next project that you have, next research that you're looking into?
Well, I'm doing two things. One is I'm working with colleagues in India and Southeast Asia on a report for UNESCO on the state of education for peace, sustainable development, and global citizenship in Asia. And that report's due to come out later this year. It's basically a sort of audit of school curricula across Asia to try and work out to what extent they are addressing issues related to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals.
Okay.
To what extent they're promoting that agenda.
Sure.
How and why, basically, they are or are not promoting that agenda. So that's one thing. Another thing is a project on the memory of war in contemporary East Asia.
That seems important. I think the Nanjing anniversary is coming up, Nanjing Massacre anniversary is coming up. So.
Yes. Well, this is my original interest in history education.
Oh, I see.
And memory. And so I'm involved in, again, this is an international project on that theme. And, I'm actually doing some research on Chinese representations of the comfort women issue, system of Japanese sex slavery during the Second World War.
That's important.
A difficult but important issue.
I think so. Okay, well, I really enjoyed talking about your book here, and we'll look forward to these other projects as they sort of roll out. Maybe we can talk in the future. But to everybody out there, go check out Education and Society in Post-Mao China, by Dr. Edward Vickers and his co-author, Xiaodong Zeng. And to everyone there, hope you learned something.